Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. On April 23, 2008, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Metley v. Glenn. The case asked whether an ERISA plan administrator that both evaluates and pays employee benefit claims operates under a conflict of interest, and, if so, how such a conflict ought to be weighed on judicial review of benefit determinations. Samuel Bray, an associate at D.C.'s Mayor Brown, discusses the case. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Bray.
This week, on April 23, 2008, the court heard arguments in MetLife v. Glenn, number 06923. This is a case about the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA, and it's likely to settle important standard of review questions that have divided the federal courts of appeals. The facts in MetLife v. Glenn are straightforward. Wanda Glenn worked for 14 years as a sales manager at Sears. Ms. Glenn had a history of heart problems, and in 2000 she was diagnosed with a serious condition in which her heart was weakened and didn't pump blood properly. Ms. Glenn's treating physician advised her to stop working and stated that she was totally disabled. Ms. Glenn followed her doctor's orders to stop work and filed a disability claim with MetLife, the insurance company that funds and administers the Sears Disability Benefit Plan. This point's important. MetLife wore two hats. It paid Sears employees any disability benefits they were owed, and MetLife decided whether they were owed any benefits in the first place. So, MetLife approved Ms. Glenn's claim and started paying benefits. And Ms. Glenn, with MetLife's encouragement, applied for and received Social Security disability payments. But then MetLife decided to stop paying Ms. Glenn's benefits. In explaining its decision, MetLife relied on the opinions of its own consultants and, to some degree, on her treating physician's opinions. But the parties disagree strongly about how to reconcile the treating physician's different opinions. Ms. Glenn worked through the appeals process at MetLife, but without success. Then Ms. Glenn sued MetLife, and this week her case ended up in the Supreme Court. The district court upheld the denial of benefits, finding substantial evidence to support MetLife's decision to stop paying benefits. But the Sixth Circuit reversed. Found a lot of things wrong with MetLife's denial of benefits, but the crucial one for this case is that it found an apparent conflict of interest because, in the court's words, MetLife was, quote, authorized both to decide whether an employee is eligible for benefits and to pay those benefits, end of quote. MetLife filed a cert petition seeking Supreme Court review of the Sixth Circuit's decision. The Supreme Court took the case, as urged by the Solicitor General. Two pieces of background are important. First, in a case almost 20 years ago, Firestone Tire v. Brook, 489 U.S. 101, the Supreme Court held that benefit denials are reviewed de novo unless the ERISA plan documents confer discretion on the plan administrator. If the plan administrator does have discretion, the standard of review is highly deferential, sometimes called abuse of discretion and sometimes arbitrary and capricious. Firestone also had a dictum relevant for this case. When a plan gives the administrator discretion, but the administrator operates under a conflict of interest, that conflict should be, quote, weighed as a factor, unquote, when a court reviews the administrator's decisions. But Firestone provided no guidance for how the conflict should be weighed as a factor. The second piece of background is the sharp disagreement in the courts of appeals. Some circuits don't require the district court to consider the bare fact that the plan administrator had both roles. But most courts insist on taking into account this conflict, which is often called a structural conflict of interest. But even these circuits disagree sharply about how the court should take it into account. Some call it a factor, some shift the burden of proof to the insurance company to show that the conflict didn't taint its decision, and some show no deference at all to the plan administrator's decision. In MetLife v. Glenn, there are two questions presented. And both are about how a court should review a plan administrator's decision when the administrator has two roles, evaluating claims and paying them. The first question presented is whether having those two roles is a conflict of interest that the reviewing court must consider. And the second question is how the court should weigh the conflict of interest. This week, the Supreme Court heard arguments in the case. The court divided the argument time three ways, part to MetLife, part to Ms. Glenn, and part to the Solicitor General's office, which is generally supporting Ms. Glenn. At the outset, several justices made clear that they were not buying MetLife's characterization of the structural conflict of interest as merely a potential conflict. Justices Scalia and Ginsburg insisted that even though a conflict of interest doesn't necessitate misconduct, the mere fact that a plan administrator pays claims from its own pocket means there's a conflict. The justices spent most of the argument time for all three lawyers probing how MetLife's structural conflict of interest could be weighed as a factor. MetLife's counsel eventually argued that courts should not consider at all the bare fact of a structural conflict of interest. But to weigh the conflict as a factor under Firestone means that it has to matter. There must be some benefit denials that would be upheld when the administrator has no conflict, but would be reversed when an administrator does have a conflict. And if the courts are to give the conflict some weight, how much? At least three possibilities emerged that argument. The first possibility was treating the conflict of interest as a tiebreaker. Imagine a kind of rule of lenity for ERISA. When a benefits claim is denied, and the evidence is equally divided on whether the denial was reasonable, and a conflict of interest is present, then ties go to the claimant. Another possibility was that the structural conflict could have a certain amount of weight as substantive evidence that would go toward deciding whether the denial of benefits was reasonable. Ms. Glenn's counsel described the zone of reasonableness as a circle. The circle is expansive for an unconflicted plan administrator, but for an administrator with a structural conflict of interest, the circle contracts, and otherwise reasonable denials would be reversed as unreasonable. Counsel for the Solicitor General's office agreed the structural conflict should be evidence in a reasonableness inquiry, but left unspecified how much weight a reviewing court should give it. A third possibility was that the structural conflict of interest would come into play only when the claimant showed that it caused the decision. For example, if an internal email showed that the insurance company started denying benefit claims for a certain procedure because it needed to hit its earnings per share targets, then the conflict of interest would taint the denials and make them unreasonable. This hypothetical hints at, but doesn't even go as far as, one real-life scandal. For about a decade, starting in the late 90s, the largest disability insurance provider, Unum Provident, systematically denied meritorious claims because it knew that plan participants would not be able to recover very much by suing under ERISA. The Unum Provident scandal is mentioned in many of the briefs in the case, but no one mentioned it at oral argument. The justices struggled with all of these options and showed little enthusiasm for any of them. Five justices, Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia, Souter, Ginsburg, and Alito, pressed counsel about these possibilities, and none seemed satisfied with the answers. Justice Scalia derided the zones of reasonableness as art, not law. And three justices, Stevens, Kennedy, and Alito, showed interest in what kind of evidence a claimant could use to show that the structural conflict of interest had particular bite for a certain company or a certain decision. Should courts look to corporate policies, such as whether the claim evaluating and claim paying divisions are walled off? Or should courts allow extensive discovery into the compensation structure for personnel who review benefit claims? Prediction is dicey, especially when the justices show so little enthusiasm for their choices. On the second question presented, no method of weighing the conflict of interest garnered much support, and two of the possibilities raised would mean a negative answer to the first question. For example, if the structural conflict of interest is a tiebreaker, then it wouldn't be weighed in every case. Still, the court seemed unreceptive to the idea that a structural conflict of interest should be ignored until a claimant somehow adduces evidence that the conflict affected the benefits denial at issue. One other point is worth noting. The court's past treatment of the connection between ERISA and trust law has been the subject of sustained criticism from the Academy. At the MetLife v. Glenn argument, this connection came up repeatedly, and two justices offered intriguing comments. Justice Breyer twice agreed with counsel that an analogy from trust law was relevant, but, there was even some exasperation in his voice, he was skeptical that the parties were offering the right analogies from trust law. And Chief Justice Roberts twice distinguished ERISA and trust law because ERISA, unlike trust law, has a policy of encouraging plan formation. The Chief Justice could have emphasized, but didn't, that ERISA restricts an employer's autonomy by requiring plans to provide a variety of substantive protections to plan participants, something trust law doesn't do, or at least doesn't do on the same scale. And which one of these two distinctions is emphasized, that ERISA encourages plan formation, or that ERISA restricts employer autonomy, could affect how the court approaches the standard of review and other major questions in ERISA. course, these hints from the justices may not amount to anything, but in a term where the Supreme Court is hearing three ERISA cases and has asked for the views of the Solicitor General on a fourth, the Court will have many opportunities to advance its understanding of ERISA.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.